From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, I say a very hearty thank you. We appreciate your support. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. This week, we're bringing you a special best of show with highlights from the earliest years of our program. With so much focus on the political religious right and the need to expose its agenda, we're spending far less time exploring the rich tapestry of belief traditions in our nation that we were able to do in calmer times. This week's Best of State of Belief is designed to remedy that, to at least a small degree. Margo Adler, who passed away in 2014, was an outspoken advocate of neo-paganism who was also an NPR correspondent and a widely read author. This week, I'd like to rewind back to our 2006 conversation on State of Belief Radio. Bishop John Shelby Spong is the retired Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey. A prolific author, teacher, and theologian, Bishop Spong has been on our program numerous times. This week, I'd like to harken back to 2009 for a conversation centering around his book, Jesus for the Non-Religious. But first, while he has not always been terribly sensitive in espousing his ideas, American author, thinker, and prominent secularist Sam Harris has always managed to garner attention. He was among the first guests to ever appear on State of Belief when he joined me to discuss his then new and still groundbreaking book, The End of Faith. From February of 2006, here's part of that conversation. I'm very pleased to welcome to the program Sam Harris, who might be called our nation's leading secularist. Sam's the author of the best-selling and award-winning The End of Faith, and in a religious country like ours, he's no stranger to controversy. Sam joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Sam, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Welton. It's a pleasure.
Your book is one of the most underlined, note-filled books in my library. I found your critique of faith enlightening, your challenges to people of faith inspiring. How is it that Sam Harris, who disdains faith, writes about faith so insightfully and so passionately?
Well, I'm paying attention to what people say they believe. I'm not coming myself out of a background of faith to which I'm rebelling against. I never really was given a religious upbringing and never really took on the conventional religious ideologies. But while I'm a critic of religious faith, and I want to argue that it's really playing a terrible role in shaping social policy and inspiring divisive conflict in our world, I am very interested in spiritual experience and in ethics and in just this whole range of positive human psychology that traditionally has been only talked about in religious terms. And so one of the things I argue in my book is that we have to find a 21st century genuinely reasonable, genuinely non-denominational way of talking about ethics and contemplative life and spiritual experience. So it's a core interest of mine, and I'm glad you found the book useful.
Sam, you are suspicious and outright critical of religion's role in national and international affairs, as you've just indicated, and yet, repeatedly, the people of this nation have affirmed the importance of religion in our national life, Now religion is used to market almost everything, from candidates for public office to public policy initiatives. How do you handle that? Do you want to move? What do you see coming next? How do you deal with this?
I think that we have to come to terms with the role that religious thinking, and specifically unjustified claims to knowledge, when they come under the guise of religious ideology, the degree to which this kind of irrationality is shaping social policy on many, many subjects, from medical research to questions like stem cell research to birth control policies in the developing world, the fact that we undermine condom use in sub-Saharan Africa while millions of people die each year from the spread of AIDS. The Vatican still preaches the sinfulness of condom use in villages in sub-Saharan Africa, where the only information about condom use is the representation of the ministry. On a whole host of fronts, we see religious ideology shaping what we do in the world that leads to the difference between living and dying for many people. And you know, we're having this conversation in the midst of this Muslim cartoon furor, which is another example of religious ideology leading to genuine social conflict. And, you know, we could just extrapolate further. I mean, it's quite conceivable it could lead to world war. I mean, there are literally religious insults that the Muslim world would find so grave that they'd be willing to die by the millions over them. And we have to come to terms that people really believe what they say they believe. And
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to pick up on a very specific point there, because I know that the stated cause of the very violent protests that are going on. I'm also mindful that the highest leaders of our government this week began to criticize what's happening and to place blame for it. And it made me ask, are we watching a conflict that is really centered in religion, or is it about politics, or is it a blend of both?
Well, you could certainly acknowledge that it's a blend of both, but that doesn't change the fact that religious ideology is only politically useful because somebody really does believe this stuff. You know, you can find examples of people at the top who are making cynical use of religion to control the masses, but that only works because the masses really do believe their dogmas. Some significant percentage of the 1.3, 1.4 billion Muslims on this planet believe that desecrating the Prophet by merely depicting him in print or blaspheming him or his teaching should be punishable by death. I mean, this is not compatible with a civil society, and we have to realize that. And so I thought our apologies and our admonishment to the Danes and the other European countries that publish these cartoons to apologize, I thought that was just an abject capitulation to the quite irrational religious convictions of the mob.
There are two questions that I like to ask all of my guests. First of all, what does religious liberty mean to you?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to answer because it's, I think that you should have the liberty to say and think whatever you want, but that comes with a couple of caveats. That does not entail any assurance that you're going to be respected for it, or that you're going to be employable in a society based on what you think and the kinds of propositions you're convinced by. I mean, for instance, you know, we do not persecute people for believing that Elvis is still alive and well and living in Middle America, but we don't respect them for this belief. And anyone who thinks that Elvis really is still alive and organizes his life around this principle will have basically excluded himself from any conversation about serious things in our culture. He's not going to become the president of a university. He's not going to be invited to sit on the board of directors. And it's a good thing that he's not, because to be mightily convinced by propositions for which you have no evidence is a bad thing. And we all recognize it's a bad thing, except on matters of religion. Likewise, someone who believes in Zeus, that person has no political future in our society, and it's a good thing because there's no evidence for Zeus. And I would extend this critique to the kinds of claims people make about religion. So while I think we should not have a gulag system, obviously, where we punish people for their religious beliefs, and we need not pass any laws against religious belief, we need to apply the same standards of criticism conversationally to religious certainties that we apply to all other certainties, and only certainties backed up by evidence and argument should survive that contest.
Second question, What is the proper role of faith, if any, in your opinion, in the public life of a person?
Well, I think faith, we use this word in a variety of senses. There's one sense in which we use it, which is it just names a kind of positive disposition, a willingness to try and persist without any guarantee that things are going to succeed for you. And I think that kind of faith, this kind of psychological positivity, is necessary and useful, and we should all have that. You know, for instance, having faith in yourself, for instance, that's a very good thing, and I have no argument against that. But faith as a willingness to believe things on insufficient evidence, uniquely on the subject of God and what happens after death, that we would criticize in every other area of our lives, but we give it a pass when it comes under the aegis of religion, that I think has no place in our society. It has no place in our lives personally. It's unnecessary. We can become mystics even without it.
My guest has been Sam Harris, secularist, extraordinaire, and author of The End of Faith. Sam, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
There's lots more still to come on this week's Best of Show. You'll hear my conversation with the late neo-pagan activist and writer Margot Adler, and later, Bishop John Shelby Spong. We'll rewind to our 2009 conversation about his really good book, Jesus for the Non-Religious. You're listening to the Best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Margot Adler was an author, a teacher, and a correspondent for National Public Radio. When I spoke to her in 2006, our focus was neo-paganism and the role of pagan traditions in our culture and our history. Margot Adler, welcome to State of Belief. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm really glad to be on Air America.
Well, I'm glad. We're glad to have you here. You have at least three distinct roles that define your life and give you meaning. And we're going to try to talk about some things that get into all of those. You're a correspondent on NPR, author of a very fine book, Drawing Down the Moon, a new edition of which is coming out in August, at the end of August. And you're a priestess of Wicca, have been since 1973. Let's begin with you giving us a quick lesson on terminology and definitions. You write and talk of paganism, neo-paganism, witchcraft, feminist spirituality, Wicca. Are these synonyms? Are they different aspects of one tradition? Can you help us distinguish here?
They are actually many different traditions of what we might call nature spirituality, some of which are old, some of which are new. Wicca, which is basically sort of Western European paganism, is sort of within this larger pagan tradition. The word pagan comes from the word paganus, you know, country dweller. And generally it's come, of course, for most people to have a lot of negative meanings, but it really means a religion that's not of the big three. It's not a religion of the book. It's not a religion of Christianity, Judaism, Islam. It's based on what people do, on their ceremonies, on various ways of, you know, what do we do to make the crops grow, to heal our community, as opposed to a literal scripture that comes down from prophets. And there are many branches within paganism, Norse religions, Druidic religions. These are all modern neo-pagan religions. There are also sort of old indigenous religions that would fall within this, that, you know, so everything from, you know, Native American, etc. But what I'm mainly talking about is this modern contemporary pagan movement, which includes goddess spirituality, Norse religions, Druids, Wiccas, etc.
So what is the best overarching term?
I think pagan.
Okay.
I think pagan would be the broad movement.
What are the most common misunderstandings of pagan religions?
Well, the first is, of course, that paganism and particularly Wicca are synonymous with Satanism. And let's, you know, Satanism is sort of reverse Christianity. You really have to believe in Christianity to believe in Satan. And if you are from a prior source, from religions that essentially are prior to Christianity, there's no concept of Satan. So it's just a complete misnomer. I think the other, there are intellectual misconceptions that pagans are sort of not deep, that they're only into ceremony, that they don't really think about ethics, none of which I think are true. That's another misconception.
Let's go back to a second to what you said about Christianity. So do you see paganism in this nation as antithetical to Christianity?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There are people who combine Christianity and pagan traditions. In fact, there's a long history of that. If you think of the Culdee Church in Ireland, which combined Christianity and sort of Tuatha De Danann and the idea of the nature spirits and so forth. So they are not antithetical.
As you know, controversy and confusion spin around the word witch or witchcraft. Talk about that term in the pagan religions. Specifically, does one become a witch or is one a witch, and what does that mean?
Well, first of all, it's important to say that the word witch is only used by a subset of groups within the pagan tradition, and that's the groups that are Wicca and some goddess spirituality groups. And they glommed onto the word witch probably for wrong reasons. I mean, they basically read, first of all, for women, witch is a very powerful term. It sort of means a woman who defines herself, who is not beholden to men, whose gods are essentially nature more than sort of reality that's on the outside of society. And it became a revolutionary term in the 60s. Then there were all these English folk traditions that basically looked at the word witch and saw that a number of folklorists like Margaret Murray said that the ancient pagan religion of Britain was witchcraft. Well, there's a lot of controversy of whether it was, but a lot of people from that ended up saying, well, if we are looking at Western European paganism, then what we're doing is witchcraft. It's not witchcraft in the sense that most people think of witchcraft. It's witchcraft as a religion that's really sort of the Western European paganism. But whether that, who uses that term, I don't find it a very comfortable term myself. There are some women who love the term in the same way that lesbians have reclaimed dyke. But for me, I find nature religion and paganism a more powerful term.
Are men welcome?
Absolutely. There are men witches, absolutely. And there are men throughout this movement. And in some of the traditions, such as the Norse religion and Norse paganism, Druid religion, it's pretty much 50-50. But I think the important thing to talk about here is that these are religions that are not based on the literal word. They are not based on scripture. They are based on experience. And as a result, they are open in a way that a lot of literalist religions are not. For example, you could never have a debate about evolution and creationism within paganism. Because basically people would say, well, yes, evolution, that's scientific truth and that's right. But then, there's my dream reality and I'm sort of like a shaman. I have my religious reality and my scientific reality and they don't conflict. They're just different parts of a larger reality. And so there would never be that kind of a conflict. And so I think what's really important about these religions, they don't proselytize. They believe that it is perfectly good to have multiple religious views in the world, that it is good to have many religions, not one, that you're not supposed to all get it down to one truth, one way, one being in the world, and that in fact, they end up being one of the greatest proponents of religious diversity and freedom in the United States.
From reading in your book, Drawing Down the Moon, I take it that pagan religions are anti-authoritarian by nature, but there seems to be a common belief in polytheism. How do you define polytheism and what are the visible implications of that belief?
Well, first of all, because this is a religion that isn't exactly one thing or another all the time, there are some groups that are not polytheistic, but most groups are. And while on the surface that belief means many gods, and there are certain traditions that have many gods, certainly if you are a follower of the Druidic religion or the Norse religion, you have many deities. And Wicca generally has two, has a god and goddess figure, so it's more duotheist than polytheist. But I think that the implication of this is that there are many ways of looking at the world, and that these gods, very often these gods are metaphors for ways of being. They are, in some cases, people do believe in them literally, and in some cases not. But it also makes you think about, for example, should there be one form of political system? Maybe a polytheistic reality would say, well, there are times when socialism is appropriate and there are times when capitalism is appropriate, and maybe we shouldn't all whittle ourselves down to one thing. Should there be one form of psychology? Should there be one? In other words, you can look at the world in a polytheistic way, as some of the Jungians like James Hillman and others did, and sort of look at a richer, more environmentally sustainable world.
One more question about the kind of the general overview of pagan religions. What are the primal rituals in these traditions?
Well, the primary rituals are, first of all, seasonal. So a lot of them go back to the ancient holidays that have been celebrated all over Europe, such as the solstices, the equinoxes, May 1st, which is Beltane, Samhain, which is All Hallows' Eve, February 1st, August 1st. They're generally their eight holidays. And then the rest of the celebrations are very much the kind of celebrations that every religious tradition creates. In other words, coming of age ceremonies, marriage ceremonies, divorce ceremonies, funerals. As a matter of fact, as the pagan community ages and has children, and now we're talking about a movement that the modern movement is like 40 years old, suddenly they've been forced to confront all the ritual needs, all the ceremonial and pastoral needs that any religious tradition has. So suddenly you have books about paganism and dying. You have so as I said, it's this broad panoply of
rituals. Are there weekly times that you get together?
Most groups have either weekly or monthly times that they get together. There are some groups that meet on the full moon, for example, some of the Wiccan groups, plus the eight holidays. There are some groups meet weekly. Some groups meet, you know, whenever they can, which is, you know, on the nearest weekend.
Right? Are groups called covens? All groups
Wiccan,
called covens?
Wiccan groups are generally called covens. Druidic groups generally call themselves groves. Norse groups call them, have a whole other name. They have kindreds. There are, you know, completely different terminology depending on this tradition.
Are these traditions growing in numbers or are they receding?
Oh, my God. Oh, are they? When I started out writing, maybe there were 100,000 people in the United States, and that might have been optimistic. Now, particularly with the internet, one scholar charted that in 2002 there were 5,000 pagan websites. And most scholars now are giving the U.S. figures at 350,000 to 750,000. So we're talking about a movement that's larger than, you know, American Quakers, American Unitarian Universalists. It's a huge movement, but it's also a very diverse movement. And so it's very hard to pin down. It doesn't have one organizational head. It's hard to sort of look at what is the structure because it's many structures.
You're a very high-profile person in this nation. Does your affiliation with pagan religions cause you problems? Do you experience prejudice because of that? What's that been like for you?
At the moment, I don't. But in the past, I did. I would say that when I first came out with my book, which was 1979, it was just at the time that I started working for National Public Radio. Before then, I had been working for Pacifica, so it was, you know, no problem. I could do anything I wanted, right? But they were very antsy. They were, you know, because a reporter is not supposed to have a point of view. And suddenly I was the spokesperson for a religion. And they were very antsy when a couple of times when host positions came up, I didn't get them. And I think that was one of the reasons. I think they were, you know, it's one thing to be a reporter because you can speak and he said, she said words. But when you're a host, you're speaking for the company. You're sort of an eye person. They were very antsy about someone with that religious perspective having that kind of a position.
Most of us recognize the at least attempted politicization of many religions in this nation, and those religions attempts to impact politics in the nation. How is it in the pagan tradition with politics?
Well, I think people have come very late to political activism. It's now happening, particularly, well, for example, I'll give you one thing that's going on right now in the news, which is that there is a campaign to have the Wiccan symbol, the pentacle, the five-pointed star, be available for veterans who die in Iraq and Afghanistan on a grave marker. There are 38 symbols that are allowed by the government, including atheism and humanism. They have their own symbols. The atheism is an atom with a various things. So, but Wicca is not allowed. And so there's been this huge push by two women who are widows to actually have this changed. Hasn't happened yet. And in this administration, who knows? A lot of environmental action. There's a pagan pride day that happens in most communities where they do a lot of charitable work and so forth and so on. There have been a number of religious freedom. There's a number of religious freedom groups within paganism that basically advocate. But it's been a slow process. It's been a
military chaplaincy organizations have recognized Wicca. Isn't that
true? Since the mid 70s.
Do you know how many chaplains there are with that?
Well,
tradition?
there are very few Wiccan recognized chaplains. It's in the book, in the military book of religions. Wicca is listed, but there are only a few people that I know that are actual working Wiccan chaplains who are working with the military and with prisoners.
You say in your writings that paganism is a way to heal the breach between the spiritual and the material realms. How are we doing on that?
Oh, we're not doing very well. But I think that when you look at the environment, you see that there are, you know, a healthy forest is, you know, has multiple species in coexistence. And I think religious reality should be like that, too. We should have many religions in coexistence, in harmony, understanding that they're just one facet of the jewel. But I think we're a long way from that, given the fundamentalist trends worldwide.
Could there be any such thing as a fundamentalist pagan?
Yes, there could, because I think that while I think it goes completely against everything in pagan principles, human nature being what it is, people can get on the wrong side of almost any belief and abuse it. And while we haven't had our Jim Joneses, you know, or whatever, it could happen.
Margot, you write that the spiritual world is like the natural world. Only diversity will save it. I happen to agree with that, tweaking it this way. Only people with an appreciation for diversity can save it. How are we doing tolerating diversity in this nation?
I think we're in a really, we're going through a really bad patch. I think that people's hearts are very open. But I think that what people are learning very often in their churches and their synagogues and in their various houses of worship and in their mosques are not an appreciation of diversity. And I think that it's going to be a long struggle.
Where do you find hope?
I find hope in ordinary people and how they live their lives every day and how, despite the messages in the media and the messages everywhere else, they come up amazingly with common sense. And I also take heart. I just did the obituary of William Sloan Coffin. And so I do believe there's a history of activist yet not overbearing and not a religion that I think we've lost and we have to get back to. And I actually think it's not the pagans, even though I think we have inspiration for you guys. I think Christianity has to return to its activist roots. And if it doesn't do that, we're in deep trouble. And I'll tell you a funny story. I heard the minister at the Abyssinian Baptist Church, Reverend Butts, say a very interesting thing. He said, "The religious right, the problems that we are having right now, are payback for Martin Luther King." And what he meant was that, in a sense, there was this huge movement of progressive religion that we have to get back to. And it was the very success of that movement which essentially got a backlash. So I think, you know, we have to fight on all levels, and you just have to accept us as pagans as allies. But we're still a minority. So, you know, we're coming on board your ship, but you got to do the big fight.
two questions that I ask all of our guests. One is, how do you understand religious freedom, the meaning of religious freedom in this nation?
I think I understand it as people came to this land to be free of religious intolerance, to set up their own ways of being. And we had incredible diversity, whether it be Quakers in Pennsylvania or wherever. And that understanding of multiplicity of different religious realities is so important and has in some sense been lost by people who say we are a Christian nation or we are this or Islam has to do such and such and such and such. So I think it means diversity. It means the ability to practice your religion freely. And that not only means in your home, it means in prison. It means, you know, in the military. On the other hand, it doesn't mean creating a government institution that has the, that is Christian or Jewish or Islamic or whatever, that I think government has to still stay out of that picture and let, you know, a million flowers bloom.
So what is the proper role of faith or religious expression or confession particularly in the lives of public high-profile individuals, such as an NPR correspondent, the President of the United States, people who are before the public all time?
You know, that's very, very hard. It's a very hard road to hoe because we live in a society right now where so many people profess their faith that if you're an atheist, you can't even run for government. I mean, you're in a really difficult bind. So I think it's important to be led by one's faith. I think it's important to allow one's faith to propel one's ethics, although you can be an atheist and have incredibly strong ethics too, and that should never be forgotten. But I think it's really important not to wear it on your sleeve. In other words, this is what is propelling my own faith, but it doesn't necessarily mean that another person who has just as strong ethics and beliefs could be propelled by a completely different faith. So I think one has to tread very carefully right now. And I think that because we're so, you know, everybody's like, it's like flag pins on your lapel. You know, everybody is saying, well, you know, God did this or, you know, and I think that's dangerous. So I'm not sure. I'm actually very confused about how you do it in such a polarized setting right now. I think, you know, 20 years ago, if we had had this discussion, it would have been very easy. We would have said, you know, you let your faith speak. If it propels you to political action, you do that political action. It's a very simple thing. Now, because of the polarization of our society and the sort of, you know, religious branding that's everywhere, I think we have to be a little more diffident, a little more careful.
What are the gifts, the positives that come from pagan traditions, both for people in the United States and for people around the world?
Well, I think there are so many, but let me start with a couple. I think that the whole movement of women's spirituality, which was part and parcel of Wicca and paganism, and essentially gave a huge number of women the gift of religious ministry, which they had been denied for decades, for forever. And suddenly you had this huge influx of women into seminaries. And we're not only talking about people becoming pagans and some of them going to Harvard Divinity School and becoming Unitarian ministers and going on a pagan path, but within liberal Christianity, within Judaism, with everything. This movement changed liturgy. It changed the number of women, and it really changed the way religion was perceived in the culture, and is really a lasting gift, I think, of the goddess spirituality movement, the pagan spirituality movement. So that's one thing. Another thing I think is that it gives the gift of understanding religion in a multinational way. You start looking at what were our roots. All of us came from other countries. We all came from other shores. And many of us threw out everything to become Americans as fast as possible. So we lost the songs, the stories, the lullabies. Now, what the pagan movement, I think, is fundamentally about is bringing back the good parts of that without the authoritarian aspects. In other words, why shouldn't you be able to dance around a bonfire at midnight and yet wake up the next day and go to work as a biologist, you know? In other words, why not being able to have both your cake and eat it, have religious tradition, exuberant ritual, ecstasy, and yet also have reason, rationality? The idea that these are not opposed, I think, is an incredible gift that is partly a gift of liberal religion altogether, but it is also a gift of the pagan movement.
Margot Adler, in addition to all else that you are and do, you're a good teacher. Thank you for joining us on State of Belief.
It's been a pleasure.
This interview was first broadcast in 2006. Margot Adler passed away in 2014. You're listening to the best of State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. The Right Reverend John Shelby Spong, retired Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey, has authored an impressive number of influential books over the years. Some consider his teachings to border on the heretical. Many others find them to be a rare gateway into a faith tradition that has always seemed exclusionary, judgmental, and barely relevant. In 2009, he had just published Jesus for the Non-Religious and joined me on State of Belief Radio to discuss the highlights. I'm going to read you some points from the writings of our next guest. Theism, as a way of defining God, is dead. So most theological God talk is today meaningless. Here's another. Resurrection is an action of God. Jesus was raised into the meaning of God. It therefore cannot be a physical resuscitation occurring inside human history. Our guest is not a leader of a growing secular humanist movement or an atheist scholar. He's the former bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Newark, New Jersey, and he's been challenging audiences for years with his analysis of modern Christianity. That tradition continues with his new book, Jesus for the Non-Religious. Recently, I spoke with Bishop John Shelby Spong about this vision of Jesus, God, and religion itself. John, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Welton.
Now, at the heart of this book is an exploration of Jesus' divinity, and I guess in particular, a new way of understanding that divinity. Tell our listeners what you see as the theological definitions of the past that you're trying to change or dispel.
Well, first, let me say that you have actually captured the essence of that book perfectly, for which I'm grateful, that it doesn't happen to me often. What I'm trying to do is to get people to see that all of our language, all of our religious language, theological language, creedal language, is human language. We created it. It didn't drop out of the sky. So we put the definitions into it. And when we human beings use the word divine, it's a human word trying to make sense out of a human experience. And then we had an experience. We tried to make sense out of the Jesus experience by suggesting that he was a visitor from outer space. All of the incarnation language suggests that Jesus came to this world from somewhere beyond the sky and did a bunch of remarkable things and then returned to his original home beyond the sky. Those concepts don't make any sense to 21st century people who live in a space age, not a three-tiered universe age, who don't live in a world where we explain things we don't understand as if they're supernatural miracles. So what we've got is the Christian church is dividing into those who can't embrace the modern world and they become fundamentalist, and those who can embrace the modern world and they give up on Christianity. So what I'm trying to do is to find a way in the middle of that malaise so that we can have a living faith instead of what I think are two dead-end streets.
John, let me ask you, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking of the old German theologians' definitions of of Jesus. Bruner and Bard and people like that talked about Jesus as the God-man. There was talk about the incarnation of God in Jesus. How would you change that language?
Well, I think that language assumes that God and life are two separate categories, that the world and heaven are two different places. And what I'm trying to do is to get people to perceive that we, none of us can define God. We can experience God, I believe, and we have to face the fact that we might be delusional, but we experience God within the realm of our life, not in the realm of God's life. And so when I talk about God, I'm not talking about God. I'm talking about my experience of God and then making sense of that experience. I believe that human beings have the capacity to become so fully human that they can commune with that which is beyond human. And that's what I call divine. And I see Jesus as not a God-man, as if those are two categories like oil and water that somehow got put together. But I see Jesus as the one who was so completely human that whatever it is that God means, and I experience God as life and love and being, whatever that God means flows through the experience of his full humanity. And I think that our job as Christians is not to make people religious. God knows we've got enough religion in this world, and most of it's pretty destructive. I think the job of the Christian faith is to make people whole, to make them more deeply and fully human, to call them into the potential that is humanity so that we can commune with God and be the better for it, you know, be people who reflect this power of life, love, and being in everything that we do.
Did anything in particular prompt this particular book?
Well, as I said in the preface, that it's been a lifetime work. The church's basic Christian myth says that we were created in God's image, perfect, and then we disobeyed God, whether that's metaphorical or historical. We called it original sin. We were expelled from the Garden of Eden. Someone said the Garden of Eden became the first gated community where you couldn't get in. And we were told that we could do nothing to save ourselves except wait on God to deliver us. And the Jesus story was told in terms of that image. Well, if you live on the other side of Charles Darwin, we know that there was no such thing as a perfect creation. So we can't possibly fall from something we never possessed, and we can never be restored to something we've never had. Life has been emerging for 4 to 5 billion years. And the problem with human life is not that we are fallen sinners, like the church has proclaimed for centuries. The problem is we haven't yet become human. And so we got to recast the Jesus story, not as the rescuer of the fallen, which makes little sense to people today, but as the empowerment of God to enable us to become fully human. And I think it turns the whole direction of Christianity around, and I think it's the way Christianity will have to go in the future. And I'm excited about that possibility.
I think you and I both know some are going kicking and screaming all the way.
Well, that's true. But Weldon, I grew up in the South, and I lived through the race battles and the civil rights movement and the desegregation. There are some people that are never going to adjust to reality, and there'll always be pockets of negativity. The fact is that time moves on. Like that old hymn says, time bears all its sons away. And if you can't adjust, your children adjust to the new reality. And if they can't adjust, your grandchildren adjust. And we have the same thing today. We've got some people that are so deeply homophobic that they would die before they see homosexual people fully welcomed into the life of the church. And the fact is they will die. And homosexuality will be looked upon in another 25 or 30 years, sort of like the way we looked on the sin of witchcraft or racism or the way we treated women or the way we were prejudiced against left-handed people. The world is going to move on, and we've got to be courageous. And if you're in touch with truth, you don't compromise in order to make people happy. Racism, sexism, homophobia, all of those things diminish the life of great numbers of human beings and cannot possibly be part of the Christian faith.
John, I'm wondering, even if there was not a direct cause and effect, as you were writing this book, did you think at all about the writings of Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins against religion?
Yeah, very much. I know Richard Dawkins. I've never met Sam Harris. And I like both of those books. Because the God they don't believe in and the God they're calling a delusion is, I think, exactly that. What I don't think they understand is that that's not the only way we can describe our God experience. If the only God that people know is the manipulative supernatural power who is constantly doing miracles and constantly enhancing guilt, then I think a reformation against that God would be quite in order. And Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris may be in the vanguard of that reformation without knowing it. I really think that they call the church to face the fact that the way we've thought about God in the past is simply inadequate for today. And if you don't have another way to talk about God, then you've got to face the fact that, as they are proclaiming, that God is a delusion. I don't believe God is a delusion, and I think we can talk about our God experience in a far more profound way than that. And I find people hungry for that kind of message all over this world, even in the Deep South, even in the Bible Belt, where I journey right frequently, and have massive numbers of people come out who are concerned to hear something different.
If you use the classic literal definition of the word atheist as one who rejects theism, do you consider yourself an atheist?
Well, that's a loaded question, because that makes good headlines. The atheist bishop, I was called that in
England.
It
makes good radio, too.
A religion reporter who didn't understand much about those dynamics. Theism is a human definition of God. I think a very inadequate human definition of God. And atheism literally means not to be a theist. Now, as long as people think that theism is the only way you can talk about God, an atheist is one who doesn't believe in any God. That would not be an accurate description. I consider myself a God-intoxicated human being. I'm almost a mystic in my experience of the reality of the holy, but without an adequate vocabulary to talk about it. So that I think that's a difficult question to answer until you define those terms. I am not a theist, but I believe profoundly and deeply in the reality of a power beyond human power that is the source of life, the source of love, the ground of being, and I call that power God, and that's the power I believe that I discern present in the life of Jesus of Nazareth, and indeed in my own life.
John, I know you've been asked this question before, because some people think around these very particular issues. People get confused about you saying that you believe in the resurrection of Jesus, though you dispute the story of the physical resurrection and ascension. Talk about how you answer that question, because it gives us insight into how you deal with a lot of other questions.
Well, I'd be glad to. I've written a 350-page book entitled Resurrection Myth or Reality, and I think it's both. I think there is a reality that I can't quite describe, and there is the mythical language that the church has used to describe it. Christianity was born in some burst of enormous energy sometime after the death of Jesus of Nazareth. Paul is the first person to write about that, and he writes 20 to 34 years after whatever that experience was. And Paul does not have any concept of resurrection being the resuscitation of a deceased body that walks out of a grave. He has the sense that resurrection and ascension are the same thing, that God has raised Jesus into the very life of God, where he participates in God's life and is therefore eternally alive and eternally available to us. But how do you describe that with human vocabulary? You're talking about a God experience, and you're trying to make sense out of it with human language. A horse can't tell you what it means to be human. A human being can't tell you what it means to be God. So we're lost in a difficulty with that. I find it fascinating that the first gospel, Mark, was written about 70, has no story of the risen Jesus appearing to anybody. Mark just confronts the women with an empty tomb and with a message that he has transcended the boundaries of death. You get the first hint of a physical resuscitation being the definition of that experience in Matthew, and it's only a hint because Matthew has the women who go to the tomb actually see Jesus and grab his feet. But Mark says the women did not see Jesus, and Luke says the women did not see Jesus, so that looks like a heightening by Matthew. And if you take that one out, the resurrection doesn't become a physical resuscitation until you get to Luke, and that would be the late 9th or maybe even the early 10th decade, and John, which would be the late 10th decade. All I'm trying to get people to see is that there is a profound difference between the experience of Jesus as breaking the boundaries of death and the way that got explained.
I have a hunch that the reason you are read so intently and so widely is that when you write for non-religious people, people who have been very religious but afraid to be honest find in your books the answers to questions, or at least responses to questions, that they've always wanted to ask but never in public. What is your hope regarding the response to this vision of Jesus from believers?
I think you have pegged it exactly right. I get letters time after time that says, you are writing the things that I've always believed, but I never felt that it was okay to believe that. You've given me permission to articulate my faith in a new direction. I think God is real. I think Jesus makes God visible in some human form. And I think the call of the Christian faith is to make us more deeply and fully human. And if we don't become more deeply and fully human, religion will be the thing that causes human beings to commit genocide, I think, against each other, because that's the way we're going. That's hardly a way you can refer to the God of life and love and being, as that you kill each other in the name of God. That's where we've gotten to in organized religion. So a Jesus for the non-religious seems to me to be something that's powerful for both believers and non-believers to come together in a new place.
Bishop John Shelby Spong's latest book is called Jesus for the Non-Religious. John, I hope you keep writing and keep challenging us to think. It was a real pleasure speaking with you here on State of Belief.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. It was great listening to those voices from the past and finding the wisdom they shared with us. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? It's incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.